from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
About the fastest time right now is 10 minutes for 100 miles. So I've told some of my friends this. I said, next time you go to get gasoline and take that 2 or 3 minutes, just set a timer and stand there for another 7 or 8 minutes. And quickly people are like, yeah, no, I'm not going to like that.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. And that's Robert Norton, our first guest on today's program. Robert is Vice President and General Counsel for Hillsdale College and also former Assistant General Counsel for Mercedes Chrysler. With a lifelong love affair with vehicles, we're going to talk today about the hidden costs of electric vehicles. Bob, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you for having me.
We want to talk a bit today about the electric vehicles, the hidden cost of electric vehicles, perhaps alternatives to electric vehicles if we're moving away from the internal combustion engine in some way. We've been talking about electric cars for so long, the Chevy Volt, which no longer exists in its form, and the Prius and others. What's the current status? What's the popularity of electric vehicles in the U.S. right now?
Well, it's certainly being pushed. So popularity, if you were to read the magazines, the automotive magazines, you're going to see a lot of hype about electric vehicles. Actually, sales were down last year. The sales did not reach the goal that they had anticipated. And I think at the root of that, you need to understand that a lot of the sales have been driven by federal tax credits that people have been receiving of about $7,500 a vehicle. Some of those vehicles now, it was to incentivize companies to build them. And so now companies such as Tesla and even General Motors, they've lost that, and mm-hmm. they're lobbying hard to get that back. But sales are actually down. Right now, it's about 2% of the U.S. fleet. When you're talking about electric vehicles, there's a first thought is, are you including hybrid vehicles, or are you just looking at all electric vehicles? But in any case, it's still about 2% of the vehicles on the road today.
The administration, the Biden administration, has set some aggressive goals for electric vehicle use across the U.S. You mentioned we already have incentives to entice people to buy these vehicles. If that's not doing the trick, what are the other alternatives that are there for the Biden administration to reach these goals?
A lot of things are on the table. There's been talk of actually making it a rebate instead of even a tax credit, so you would be assured as a consumer that you're going to get the check in the mail. There's been about $100 billion earmarked to specifically incentivize people to buy the vehicles.
Let's talk a bit about the electric grid when it comes to electric vehicles. Is our grid in its present form anywhere near adequate to charge the number of vehicles that, say, the Biden administration wants to have in use in this country?
No way near adequate for the job. When I was at Chrysler or Mercedes Chrysler, we looked at alternatives to getting off of fossil fuel, you know, back in the day. And as we scaled the likely alternatives that the United States government would use, the winner of the contest at that time had been hydrogen, mm-hmm. and California was going to be a big partner in that, creating what they called a hydrogen highway. They were going to put in these hydrogen refueling units one way or another. And so Mercedes put a lot of money into developing hydrogen. And then after that, there were things such as biodiesel. And then we looked at different grades of, like, gasoline, if you will, fuel that could be used. And way down the list was electric. And one of the reasons for that is that the consuming public wouldn't stand what it would do to their home electric bills. Mm. And at that time, it was estimated that it would be about 400% more that people would pay for their home electric bill in order to get the grid up to speed, if you will. Many people don't realize that the way your electric bill is figured out is that the electric company puts together all the costs, and then they present it to, in many places, a panel mm-hmm. of people from the community, and they say, gee, here's the cost, and we want to make 20% more than that. And the panel looks at it, analyzes it, hems and haws, and then they kind of look at each other and go, well, what are we going to do? Uh-huh. And so then they end up approving that rate that gets passed on to the consumer.
Now, from an infrastructure perspective, at least a number of these cars, I mean, it's not a normal plug in the wall. There has to be upgrades to someone's house or garage to have that available. And I was reading that even like the transformers that you see, you know, on the power lines, the big units would have to also change to allow the amount of electricity through. Does that sound right?
Yeah, a friend of mine is an electrician, and we just happened to see him over Memorial Day, and he said that one of the businesses that is doing quite well for electricians in the Metro Detroit area has been installing these chargers in people's homes. It runs about $1,000, he said, and it's a 240-volt mm-hmm. charger that the person pays for. And a lot of them are tied to the automotive industry, and they're getting their free, you know, executive car, air quotes. And so then they're putting in these chargers. They don't mind the cost. And he said he was struck by the fact that people were coming out and preaching to them, to him in the garage, as to how they're doing the environmentally correct thing. And it's a noble cost. I don't mind paying this. But I think if the average person who owns a gasoline vehicle was told, oh, by the way, you got to put a $1,000 thingy in what? Your garage, that wouldn't have gone over nearly so well. So there's a lot of propaganda and virtue signaling, if you will, that's going along with it.
And has there been a discussion about if, again, there is sort of this mass adoption of electric vehicles and everybody comes home from work at 5 o'clock and wants to recharge a vehicle, there's a load on the electrical system that's going to be massive at that point. Can we handle that sort of thing at this time?
We're nowhere near being able to even consider handling it, to give you an idea. You figure that when you recharge a car, now, of course, it depends how far you've driven it, how long it's on the charger, but a general working rule is it's the same as roasting a turkey in an electric oven for 8 hours. So some of the studies so far show people that are driving electric vehicles, it's about the same amount of energy they were using it for their household per year now to charge their vehicle or vehicles. And of course, you know, in the Michigan area, many of us have 2 and 3 vehicles in our household.
Sure.
So if everybody gets home and you plug in 3 vehicles, of course, you'd have to have 3 of those $1,000 chargers if you want to do it quickly. Or it takes about 9 hours on a 110 charger. But to your point, you know, it's not just a little bit more. You know, all of the power lines and that we see, you're going to need more of those. We're going to need big power lines, and that means more copper. And the price of copper was already up 60% last year. So you would have a huge demand for things like copper and some of these other materials.
Talking with Bob Norton, Vice President General Counsel at Hillsdale College, also former Assistant General Counsel of Mercedes Chrysler. Before we move off sort of this charging topic, we discussed doing it at home, but clearly people will need to do it when they're not at home, whether it be for longer road trips or just being out and about and needing to recharge. Are we relying on the government to install the charging stations that will be needed for electric cars across the country? Will there be something, in your mind at least, like private charging entities, like, you know, the BP, the Mobil, the Citgo at this point?
Well, there already are private charging companies out there. You can even buy stock in them. But I think what the government is offering, I don't think there's been a lot of specificity, is they're going to subsidize those businesses in the effort of running those cables and getting them there. Because, you know, you and I might want to have a meter we charge people to charge their vehicle. But if we're talking about 240 volts in order for it to be a quick charge, and we should talk about what that is in a minute, but the 240-volt line has to get there. So in many cases, you're going to have to, you know, dig up the parking lot, run the trench, bury the cables, and then have it come out of the ground, and now you attach the device to it. So I think that there's 500,000 charging units that is going to be added. Let's just get some perspective. I think right now in the United States, we have 333 million vehicles on the road. So if 333 million vehicles are going to need to have a charge, and if a quick charge to get 100 miles is 10 minutes, and most people leave their vehicle on the charger for 45 minutes for a full charge, do the math, and 500,000 is that proverbial drop in the bucket.
On the subject of a quick charge, which you mentioned, now, all of us who drive these days will pull up to a gas station and take 3 minutes to fill up, and we can go 400 more miles. What's the equivalent of that for an electric car?
Well, there's different cars have different capacities, right? So that's one of the competitive advantages that car companies will give you. But about the fastest time right now is 10 minutes for 100 miles. So I've told some of my friends this. I said, next time you go to get gasoline and take that 2 or 3 minutes, just set a timer and stand there for another 7 or 8 minutes. And quickly people are like, yeah, no, I'm not going to like that. Now, let's just say hypothetically it was a 0-degree day in Michigan, and you're going to have to do this. And by the way, the 0-degree day means you need more charge,
right?
Because the heater and the wipers have got to use that same battery. So, you know, Michigan is a good example of a place where most people would not find owning an electric vehicle very ideal, because you're going to have to plan probably several stops along the way to charge your vehicle for, say, 45 minutes.
We'll pause right there. Bob Norton is with us, Vice President, General Counsel for Hillsdale College, and former Assistant General Counsel for Mercedes and Chrysler. We're talking about the hidden costs of electric vehicles. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Bob Norton, Vice President and General Counsel for Hillsdale College, and also a former Assistant General Counsel for Mercedes, Chrysler, and a long time, lifelong, in fact, lover of cars, about the hidden costs of electric vehicles. Talk a bit about the battery, these massive batteries that are needed in these electric vehicles. Do we have an idea of what it costs to replace that battery if it fails, or if eventually it just runs out? You know, we all have batteries. We have cell phone batteries. After a while, it starts to lose the ability to hold the charge it used to. If you want to change your car battery, electric car battery, what does that cost? What does that entail?
Well, you've done your research, because you're onto a very dicey subject in the industry right now, and some people will be cringing in the automotive industry that you've stated that specifically. So, for example, there is, I'd say, a fair amount of hide the ball going on in the industry, including giving very long warranties on the batteries, so people don't have to fret their pretty heads about what it's going to cost. 8 years, 100,000 miles, let's not really talk about the cost. But we do have some insight. There was one vehicle that struck a large rock on a Tesla, and Tesla said, well, we do warranty it, and by the way, they'll even warranty virtually any kind of fire your car's in. That's been a little bit of a joke in the industry. You go ahead and light your car on fire, because then Tesla will warranty the battery, because they don't want to talk about battery fires. That's another, interesting moment. But this vehicle struck a rock, and they said, now clearly striking a rock is not considered a warranty issue. And in that case, the cost of the battery and the labor was $15,000.
It's a third of the price probably you paid for the car.
Right. And then another fact with batteries, you pointed out your cell phone battery on your phone. You notice it doesn't last as long as you'd like it to, right? We all wish, and we've all had that end-of-life battery experience where you're constantly on the charger.
Yep.
It's the same technology in larger scale that will happen to the vehicles. You know, they put some extra capacity in there, but you're going to get to 80%, 70%, 60%. At some point, and it's going to be even more of a nuisance to be doing those 10 and 45 minute charges, because you're going to need more of them.
And when those batteries are replaced, if those batteries are replaced, they're full of these rare earth metals, which I want to talk about in a moment, and they're large, they're massive batteries. What do we do with them after they've been used? That seems a question that has to be answered as well.
Yeah, the rare earth comes in several forms. The batteries, it's not so rare. I mean, the people would say, that's lithium and cobalt and relatively abundant. But the end-of-life issue is a very real issue. And again, the industry, it's sort of comical for those of us who've been in other industries and that to hear people saying things like, don't worry, we're just going to use them in the power grid. You don't have to worry about where they ultimately will go when they go to heaven. We'll just keep kind of magically refurbishing them, and let's not talk about it. Because the talking about it is fairly ugly from an environmental point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Volkswagen, I believe, is the only company that's come up with an official recycling plant. And the way they're going to go about it is to crush them back to fine powder to allow there to be ultimate recyclability. But then you start to say things, well, what kind of fine powder and what comes out the other end of the factory? And they say, it's just in the early stages. Let's not talk about that.
Okay, on the subject of the rare earth metals that are needed, if they're not needed so much in the battery, where are they needed in the vehicle? And then where do we find them? Where do we get them? What are the costs of acquiring those metals?
Yeah, you're onto a very important topic, I think, there from a national security point of view. And surprisingly, perhaps, the Biden administration agrees with me on that, that these rare earth metals are a very big deal. And right now, the world supply of the rare earth magnets, the magnets are used in the motors, to answer your question. And in order for the motors to work efficiently and to try to give us as much range as possible, you really need these rare earth metals. I'm not going to try to pronounce them all for you. But to give you an example, Australia is proud of the fact, and they're making a fairly big deal about the fact, that they have some of these rare earth metal mines in Australia. And they boast at the fact that they produce 17,000 tons of this material a year. And that sounds great until you compare it to the fact that China right now is producing 140,000 tons. It is almost completely dominated by China. It's not by accident. They've gone all over the world locking this up. They also have intellectual property rights that they've been wise in securing. As much as they don't often like other people's intellectual property rights and patent rights, they did a good job of making sure that they have protected their intellectual property here. And I would say that there's no one happier that we are making this dedication towards supposedly improving the environment by going to electric vehicles than China. The only plant that even processes the material outside of China is in Malaysia.
Talking with Bob Norton about the hidden cost of electric vehicles, something I think about. We're here in Hillsdale. Many of our friends and neighbors have a number of children. And so we see the big, they used to be the Ford Econoline vans, which are called something else these days. But I wonder about the ability of this technology to power the big SUVs that people tend to want, to power these larger vans that large families will need. I know Ford is just now testing this, the big pickup technology. We saw the president driving one of them a few weeks ago. But where we are right now, is battery technology advanced to provide the power needed for the larger vehicles like that?
No. Not in the way you're thinking at all. So, for example, there's, again, a little bit of misinformation. People will talk about the tremendous towing capacity of a vehicle with three electric motors, and that they have 1,000 horsepower. And, boy, they can pull 11,000 pounds, for example, is used by some of the Cybertrucks out mm-hmm. there. The Cybertruck, I think, actually is a brand. But some of the electric trucks will say they can tow 11,000 pounds. But what they don't say is for about 70 miles. In one of the puff pieces put out by an electric truck manufacturer, they say with a 500-pound payload, and then they go on to talk about a trailer, and thinking, well, suppose it is one of the families, right? We can pick on the Whalens. They're pretty good at picking on them, right? You get the Whalen family. It would be hard for the entire Whalen family to weigh in at 500 pounds,
yeah.
Let alone their luggage, maybe the family dog, and some groceries. And then now they got to add a trailer to it. It gets to be actually kind of comical. That you would load up this big trailer, it would be probably a funny video you and I could make. Load up the vehicle with what you might see on a given holiday weekend, and then show it to head down the road for a relatively short distance and virtually out of sight. It's out of power, and now you need that 45-minute charge to go that next distance.
Right. We're kind of smart guys here, and we've spent the past 20 minutes or so talking about difficulties with this technology. If we can do it here, other people are certainly thinking about the same things. Why, from an industry and, I guess, governmental perspective, is there this myopic view of the future of automobiles? Why is this focus solely on electric as the future?
It's a good question, and it really came down as a hard policy decision by the United States government. When the United States government offered $7,500 and $10,000 tax credits, I was working for Mercedes at that time, and the Germans in particular were livid and would ask me why was our government giving such a credit for a car built in Japan without even the lug nut being put on the United States. And they would go on to say they thought that was just amazingly stupid. And I kind of agreed with them and said, yeah, I don't think it's a good idea either. But it's been this policy, as you pointed out, myopic focus. And I think there's a belief that because the energy can be produced through solar and wind, that's another point. You know, at this point, I don't know that we've reached 5% of our energy production, and let alone the 25% goal that we've set.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't like the current state of the view of windmills and solar panels, just wait to see if we have to increase our grid by 400%
mm-hmm.
for electric cars. And we wanted to get to 25%. You can start to picture windmills everywhere you look. But in any event, I think there's this belief that, oh, we'll find ways to produce electricity. It gives us this versatility. But then we don't want it to be coal, we don't want mm-hmm. it to be nuclear, we don't want these other agendas, and it gets to be rather complicated.
Bob Norton, current Vice President, General Counsel at Hillsdale College, but previously Assistant General Counsel at Mercedes Chrysler, has worked with compliance and government affairs and has written a number of articles on this topic as well. You can find them with a quick search. Bob, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we talk with historian Arthur Herman from the Hudson Institute about General Douglas MacArthur. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR Shasta is also broadcasting at K243CT Reading.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay? The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to a North State with no more homeless pets.
Happy holidays from our Home Helpers family to yours. At Home Helpers, we are proud to help your loved ones celebrate this holiday season from the safety and comfort of their own homes. We are equally proud of the men and women who can't be with us. To the bravest among us, far from home serving our country this holiday season, to all members of the military in all branches, past and present, and those who made the ultimate sacrifice, with respect, gratitude, and love, we thank you. Happy holidays from all of us at Home Helpers. Life takes you to unexpected places. Love brings you home.
The official meeting of the Business to Business meeting is called to order. Business to Business, where we always say, make every transaction a win-win-win. Our guest today is Steve Clark from Minuteman Press of Reading.
Today I'd like to talk to you about business cards.
I just get mine from this.
Don't say it. Don't do it. If you're thinking of ordering your business cards online, don't do it. Keep your business local.
But they're cheaper online.
No. Business cards from Minuteman Press of Reading start at just $35, and custom design services start at $29, and you keep your money local.
Hey, that's a win!
Let us at Minuteman Press of Reading take care of your business cards. Rapid turnaround time and priced right. We also do full-service direct mail and promotional products at Minuteman Press of Reading.
Call 221-0400. That's 221-0400.
For Minuteman Press of Reading, where we design, print, and promote you.
221-0400. That's 221-0400.
Minuteman Press of Reading. Call today.
Save room for a wish this month at Black Bear Diner, where they partnered with Make-A-Wish to help grant life-changing wishes for children with critical illnesses in our community. They're donating $1 from the purchase of every delicious slice of red velvet cake, candy cane chocolate cream pie, and peppermint cheesecake now through the end of the month. Get on over to Black Bear Diner because wishes need stars like you. Open daily, including Christmas Eve and day. 2605 Hilltop Drive.
Black Bear Diner.
Have you been putting off getting your colonoscopy due to COVID restrictions? Well, there's no better time than now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
And we co-host Writing Roots.
It's a 10-minute podcast in which we, an author,
and her editor,
cover lessons we've learned about the writing process.
Writing Roots is available on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your podcasts. And don't forget to always
write selfishly.
Are you not getting treatment for a work injury because of denials? Call me, Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, at 530-262-2168, and I will get you results. The insurance company and your employer have an attorney working hard for them. You need somebody fighting for you. When you call Gorman Law, you're going to speak with me, not a paralegal, because the last thing you should be worried about is whether or not your attorney is working for you. There is no cost until your case is settled. Consultations are free and confidential. Call today, 530-262-2168. That's 530-262-2168.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For more information about Hillsdale College, you can head to hillsdale.edu. Joined now by Dr. Arthur Herman, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute and Director of Hudson's Quantum Alliance Initiative. He's also the author of Douglas MacArthur, American Warrior.
Dr. Herman, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk MacArthur.
Let's talk about the Big Mac.
Yes, you wrote a book. What made you interested in MacArthur?
Well, I got interested in MacArthur because of the work that I did on the Freedom's Forge, my book on the making and the arsenal of democracy in World War II. And there were aspects of the development of military technology that took place in the Southwest Pacific Theater, which was MacArthur's theater during World War II. And that got me interested in the degree to which the Southwest Pacific Theater really was a very, very interesting theater of operations during World War II. Most people know it, I suppose, as a setting for the musical South Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it was pivotal to the course of World War II in the Pacific. And MacArthur, as you look at his career, you become to understand what a real military visionary and geopolitical visionary he was. And I felt he was owed a biography that handled not only his contribution in World War II, but also his incredible role as a combat leader in the First World War and then as the supreme commander during the Korean War as well. There's not many figures in American history you can sort of say this was a consequential military leader in three world wars, First World War, Second World War, and the Cold War. MacArthur is the one who fills that designation.
Take us a bit through MacArthur's childhood, being raised in a military family.
He grew up in a military family, born in a military barracks in Arkansas. His father was a Civil War hero, a Medal of Honor winner during the Civil War, and was a man destined for the very top positions in the U.S. Army. Everyone recognized Arthur MacArthur's brilliance, his dedication to his profession. But a big turning point for Arthur MacArthur was when he became engaged and interested in America's role in Asia. And as I explain in the book, one of the things to really understand about Douglas MacArthur and why he becomes such an important figure in shaping U.S. policy in the Pacific, first in the Philippines, then during World War II in the Southwest Pacific Theater, and then during the Korean War, was it really was in many ways the legacy of his father, who explained to his son America's destiny lies not in Europe, but its destiny lies in Asia, and how it brings the light of democracy and economic freedom into that region of the world. And I think that's one of the reasons that makes MacArthur's story, father and son, but particularly son, so relevant to where we are today when we're confronting these issues right now in the United States in 2020.
You mentioned he's in World War I, he's in World War II, he's in the Korean War.
Win 7 Silver Stars in the First World War. Count them, 7 in combat.
How did he do that?
Well, I think there's a couple of aspects about MacArthur that we have to bear in mind that really is characteristic of him throughout his career. The first is that he is the master of the unconventional. Everything he does is different from the usual conventional approach to whatever job in the U.S. Army he's conducting. His role in World War I, he's a staff officer, but he feels that it's important as member of the general staff to see what's happening on the front line. So he gets himself involved in military operations in the trenches, going over the top here, when he is, number one, not carrying a weapon, not even a sidearm, but simply going as part of his responsibility as a leader and as someone who is got to understand what his troops are facing in the front lines. 7 Silver Stars are the result of that. The second thing is that he also brings his own personal style. We think of him mm-hmm. always with the corncob pipe and the hat with the gold braid and the eagle. Even in World War I, even before World War I, he had evolved his own idiosyncratic style of dressing in uniform that was a trademark that he knew his troops would always recognize as part of his leadership, that MacArthur was with us and we've got nothing to worry about when you see that corncob pipe on the firing line. And then the third aspect of it is he was never afraid to tell superiors when he thought they were doing the wrong thing. And that included a U.S. president, Harry Truman. And in the end, that spelled really the finish of his career and really brought him down and got him dismissed during the Korean War. And what's amazing about Douglas MacArthur is, given his penchant for talking back to superiors and telling exactly what he thought of them and then doing what he wanted, it's amazing his career was as stellar and as long and consequential as it really was. I think it was a recognition that even those who he drove crazy and who had, in the end, he confronted serious policy reservations, Truman, General Marshall, General Pershing during World War I, all recognize this is a truly exceptional soldier, an exceptional leader, and it's much better to have him on our side than otherwise.
Tell us about that decision by President Truman to dismiss MacArthur. Why was, you know, he had these conflicts previously, he had opposed decisions previously. What was this one about? Why was it different than
the other
times?
Well, this is a firing which is steeped in controversy to this day. The question comes up, did Truman fire MacArthur? Should he have done it? Did he do it too soon? Which is partly what I argue in the book. Did he do it too late? And there are those who see, or MacArthur critics, who see his policy and his strategy in Korea as being disastrous almost from the beginning, and hoping that someone else had been placed in supreme command. The real issue with MacArthur was not what was happening on the battlefield. In fact, as I explain in the book, the tide of war had moved decisively on the Americans' favor. After the Chinese troops had descended into the Korean Peninsula, to everybody's shock and surprise, starting in October of 1950, by February of 1951, what looked like an enormous, catastrophic U.S. defeat and disaster had been reversed. MacArthur and his commander on the ground, Matthew Ridgway, had really turned the tide against the Chinese, and they were rolling back up the Korean Peninsula, advancing on the North Korean capital, Pyongyang, about to take it for the second time in the course of that war, and to push the Chinese all the way back to the Yalu River. So it was not the course of the war that caused MacArthur's dismissal. It was a letter that he had written to the Republican Speaker of the House, Joe Martin, complaining about the degree to which the Truman administration and certain senior officials and advisors had really tied his hands in being able to deal with China's unexpected entry into the Korean War. And that letter was read aloud in the House of Representatives by Representative Martin. Not that MacArthur had anything to do with that or even knowledge of what was taking place. But the release, the leaking, as we would say today, of this information about MacArthur's criticism of the Truman administration was really kind of the last straw for MacArthur's critics, who had built up a drumbeat of criticism and of attacks on him. And for Truman, he felt that this was a act of insubordination that really threatened the balance between U.S. civilian and military leadership and of the president as commander-in-chief. I have to say, having reviewed all the evidence and gone and looked at this case, I think, in some detail for writing my book, I think to a degree Truman was right. But I also think MacArthur was right. MacArthur's strategy for winning the Korea was, in fact, a really good one.
Dr. Arthur Herman, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute and Director of Hudson's Quantum Alliance Initiative, also author of the book Douglas MacArthur, American Warrior. Dr. Herman, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Happy to be here.
Up next, we talk with Daryl Hart from Hillsdale's History Department about what Americanization has done to Protestantism in the country. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The State Cultural Education Center and SCAR in partnership with Skokie and the Shasta Beloved Community is having a COVID-19 vaccination clinic Thursday, December 30th from 10:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at First Methodist Church at 1825 East Street. All COVID-19 vaccines will be available, including boosters. Children ages 5 to 17 are also welcome and must have a parent or guardian's consent and an adult with them. Enjoy free Punjabi Indian food while organizers hand out gift cards. This COVID-19 vaccine clinic is dedicated to Umoja Kwanzaa. No insurance, no appointment needed. December 30th, First Methodist Church, Reading.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
Your friendly old change.
Many accidents are caused by worn wiper blades. Let's face it, it's just uncomfortable when you're driving in the rain, snow, fog, and everything else in between with worn blades. At Premier Oil Change, when you buy one wiper blade, you get the second blade free. Yes, now through January 15th, you buy one wiper blade and get the second one free for as little as $15.99. At Premier Oil Change, we make maintaining your car easy. There's no need for an appointment. You don't drop your car off or wait. Just pull in, enjoy a free beverage, and free Wi-Fi while our trained technicians perform our comprehensive 30-point certified service. Earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Learn more at PremierOilChange.com or visit us in Palo Cedro. Premier is in the Holiday Market Shopping Center or in Redding on Lake Boulevard next to Waterworks Park and our newest location in Anderson across from Round Table Pizza. All locations, you get a free car wash with every oil change. Home of the friendly oil change.
North State Now is a magazine formatted show at 6 p.m. every Thursday night. The first Thursday is yours truly, Linda Bott, featuring what's going on in our town. The second Thursday is hosted by Michelle Slade, featuring heroes of the North State. The third Thursday is hosted by none other than James Masada and Rhonda Alvey from Enjoy the Magazine and Enjoy the Store. Our newest edition is the fourth Thursday of the month, Women of Vision. That's North State Now, Thursday at 6 p.m., also streaming on KCNR 1460.com.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300. A reputation for excellence since 1965.
NorCal Tractor Trailer Rentals and Sales enjoy giving back and supporting our community. That's why when they were asked to join the Hero Circle for Heroes of the North State Toys for Tots Toy Drive, it was an easy yes. The thought of helping to give to children in Shasta County this Christmas season and helping bring joy to their hearts has been a blessing to them all. NorCal Tractor, Trailer, and Rentals would like to thank the community for rising above and providing giggles and laughter this holiday season.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello and welcome to one of our new radio affiliates, 1450 Talk Radio WMIQ in Iron Mountain, Michigan. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined by Dr. Daryl Hart, Distinguished Associate Professor of History,
at Hillsdale College. Dr. Hart, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And you were teaching a class, History of American Religion, at Hillsdale, and thought it would be nice to go through a couple of the topics in that course, talking today about what Americanization does to Protestantism. First, we see Protestants among the earliest U.S. colonists, correct?
Yes, primarily English. That's what we teach here in American Heritage, with starting with the Puritans and the Virginians and working in the Quakers and others. But there were, you know, there were Dutch settlers as well, so I try to include some of those other voices, but the English narrative really becomes a dominant story in colonial period.
From those early days, how do we see Protestantism grow in America?
Largely, and this would be true, I guess, for most religious traditions, aside from a few like Mormonism, perhaps, but just by simply immigration. I mean, the people who come and settle, and the big theme in American religion that I try to get across is the transplanting of generally European religion, which is largely Christianity, Judaism as well, but transplanting that to North America, and then how much of that carries over. Different immigrants in the 17th century are going to be different from immigrants in the 19th century, what their expectations are from the homeland coming to the new world. But that's how it happens. So I tell students that it wasn't as if Native Americans wrote letters to Geneva or Rome and said, send us some Christians over here to evangelize us. No, it's just that a lot of Christians came from Europe to settle in North America, and then churches have a different kind of life here from European churches.
This answer could take a while, but you know, Protestant is an umbrella term that has these branches. Can you kind of briefly delineate between the major branches in the U.S. and perhaps where they came from? We talk about Baptist, Lutheran, Calvinist, Pentecostal.
Right. Well, the four big categories from Protestantism at the time of the Reformation are Anglican, Lutheran, let's go Lutheran, then Anglican, Reformed or Calvinist or Presbyterian, they're all sort of the same. And then Anabaptist, we're surrounded by Amish here in Hillsdale County, and they come from that background. So those are the four big groups, but they all play out differently in European settings. But the major Protestant group in the United States after the founding era, but even going back to the colonial era, are the churches that come out of the British background. Those would be Anglicans or Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, which would have been Puritans, Baptists, Quakers, and Methodists. Those are sort of the five or six big denominations that wind up becoming, in effect, the Protestant mainline or Protestant mainstream. And I've been struck teaching this course how much that ties to England or ties to Britain make a big difference for sorting out Protestant groups in the United States. And then ethnic Protestants come later, and they have to sort of figure out their relationship to the churches from the British background. But it's the British who sort of run the show, even though they're not necessarily claiming that pride of birthplace or something.
Now, the term evangelical, what do we mean by that term generally, and is that really an American phenomenon?
I used to work at a place, well, at Wheaton College, and I was director of the Institute for the Study of American Evangelicals. So I know way too much to try to give a simple answer. But one way of thinking about evangelicalism is to look at the revivals of the first Great Awakening. Mm-hmm. I prefer to call it Pretty Good Awakening. I have deference to a friend who came up with that term. And that would be Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, sort of new birth, sometimes big gatherings of people. And so people have this dramatic encounter with God and conversion experience. But more recently, evangelicalism is much more post-World War II phenomenon. People associate oftentimes that evangelicalism with a figure like Billy Graham, who has similarities with Whitefield and Edwards as an evangelist, although sort of different in different ways as well, theologically. And that post-World War II phenomenon is in some ways a predecessor to the religious right, which also then feeds into the conservative movement and the Republican Party. So that takes on a different character perhaps in the 70s, 80s, and beyond. So it's less churchly in a way. It's sort of happening outside churches, and it winds up also having a political aspect to it.
Dr. Daryl Hart with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, talking about what Americanization does to Protestantism. What about that? What effect would you say that America has had on Protestantism, and how is it adjusted to sort of a voluntary church environment that we have here in America?
Right. I guess you could say that Protestants adjusted the best to a voluntary, meaning a disestablishment environment, where you didn't have states, which is still the pattern throughout Europe in many places, states supporting churches in some way through taxes or other financial means. Protestants had to adjust to different environment after the founding. Of course, there were still state churches in different states, Massachusetts being the last to disestablish in the 1830s. And revivalism, or the kind of evangelicalism that we see today, is remarkably savvy to markets, to different means of getting the religion out, to different techniques, different media. And in that sense, you could say that the people who were promoting revivals even in the 18th century had a leg up on other groups to try to get the word out and attract followers. So I think there are probably a lot of Protestants in the United States who think that's sort of the norm.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the nature of church life, when in fact they've forgotten the way church life used to be, whether Roman Catholic or Protestant, in the old world. So, and there are debates among scholars about whether that's been a good thing or a bad thing for religion. And there's probably, I mean, one of the ways of putting it is you could say that religion is a mile wide, Protestantism a mile wide, but an inch deep.
Mm.
Because when you get that kind of voluntary, free market, entrepreneurial spirit, you also lose some of the theological, liturgical depth that you might have had in Christianity before the modern era.
Every now and then we see the polling about religion in America. The Protestant share was more than 50% for a long, long time, and recently has dipped below 50%, still the largest share, of course. Do you think that says something about us as a country where we are right now?
Yes, I do, in the sense that I think throughout most of the 20th century, I would say there was still a civil religion that had a lot of Protestant inflection to it, and a sense that, as we say in the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation under God, or on our coins, in God we trust, there was a sense, at least, that was a pretty much a Christian or Judeo-Christian God. And if Protestants put a lot of effort and energy into that, and if they are declining in numbers, that's going to probably change at least the civil religion and the sort of religious nationalism that at times has been a big part of American life. We're in a very uncertain time. I just finished a course on the post-Cold War America, and in fact it seems to me that once the Cold War ended, America has been trying to figure out itself. And I think without a large religious constituency or majority or something, that's a further aspect of that.
Dr. Daryl Hart, Distinguished Associate Professor of History here at Hillsdale College, talking about his History of American Religion course, Protestantism this time. Dr. Hart, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Great. Thanks, Scott.
And that will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Bob Norton, General Counsel here at Hillsdale College, talking about the hidden costs of electric cars. We also heard from Arthur Herman on General Douglas MacArthur. And finally, Dr. Daryl Hart from Hillsdale's History Department on what Americanization has done to Protestantism. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. You can follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or over on Facebook. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next time, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Deco Manufacturing Company presents How People Make Things at Turtle Bay now through January 9th. Explore this new and interactive exhibit where kids can learn firsthand about the tools and processes used to make objects that we see and use every day. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
100 years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Today, Simpson University continues to provide a Christ-centered education, graduating students with mature and infectious faith, critical competence, and a ready spirit to thrive as servant leaders around the world and at our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Hi, my name's Nick Gardner. I have a show here on KCNR, Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. every other Sunday. The name of my show is Poke the Hornet's Nest.
There's no mountain I can't climb. There's no tower too high. No plane that I can't learn how to fly. What do I gotta do to get through to you to show you there ain't nothing I can't take this chainsaw to?
I'm going to concentrate on local politics mainly, but we'll talk about national politics also. You'll get the view of the common citizen here in Redding, California. And remember, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Maybe it's a good time for a new perspective about what's been going on in our town, in our state, in our nation. I hope you tune in and hear the other side of the news.
Everybody, listen up! Hi, I'm Janet McCarn, one of the owners of Orchard Nutrition Center. We are proud to be joining KCNR in sending holiday greetings and wishes to all our veterans and those currently serving our country, and to their families waiting at home. It is a huge sacrifice they make for our country, and Orchard Nutrition Center is proud to honor our veterans every day with a 10% in-store discount. Sending warm wishes from the Orchard Nutrition Center family to all our veterans today and all year long. Thank you for your service.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 and 1460 AM.
Fabulous fall specials going on now at High Noble Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane, also in Roseville and Petaluma. High Noble Safe Company has fireproof and waterproof safes. Protect your guns, cash, and valuables, heirlooms, and collectibles, and important documents. With delivery, moving, and repair service available in Redding, Roseville, and Petaluma. Call 530-223-5050. That's 530-223-5050, or stop by High Noble Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane today.
Turn your someday into today. The Shasta College spring semester begins January 19th, and now's the time to register for classes. First-time, full-time students.
Get your first 2 years tuition free. At Shasta College, we'll teach you the skills, give you the knowledge, and provide the training you need to unlock your potential. Reskill, upskill, or get transfer ready at Shasta College. Go to www.shastacollege.edu/apply.
Make this New Year's Eve a night to remember at the Reading Garden of Lights. Featuring two stages of live music, food trucks and bars throughout the gardens provided by Mosaic, all surrounded by a magnificent holiday light show. Tickets available at turtlebay.org.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center. Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888. The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.